You're listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture.
You know, if somebody says, where are you from? My answer is very long. And that's allowed us to work abroad. And it's allowed me to feel very comfortable in going in any country and sort of, you know, figuring out, understanding a culture, because I've had to live in so many different cultures, and sort of it sort of comes much more naturally.
Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture, with me, Owen Wainhouse.
I'm Christina Seilen, founder of Studio Seilen Architects. And I remember very well the landing in Boston and seeing the scale and suddenly thinking, oh, this is really exciting. You arrive from the airport and you kind of go through a tunnel, and then you emerge and you're on an elevated highway and you're sort of not quite skyscrapers like New York, but it's still that scale. And I just thought, oh, this is really, I want to be part of that. And so very early on, as soon as I could, I took the first foundation course of architecture, and that was my last class of biology.
Our guest this week has led something of a peripatetic life. Born to an Austrian father and a German mother, Christina Seilen grew up in Switzerland before moving to the United States with the intention of studying biology at Wellesley College in Massachusetts. But she soon dropped biology and switched direction to study architecture at MIT and then at Columbia University in New York. After working for a number of smaller practices, in 1997, she took on a junior job in the model shop at Raphael Vanoli Architects in New York, where she quickly rose through the ranks, going on to become a director and working on major projects, including Princeton University. In 2001, she relocated to London, where she was charged with opening Vanoli's new European office, steadily growing the office over 5 years, from just her to a staff of more than 50. Christina won and oversaw a number of major jobs for the practice, including the Curve Theatre in Leicester and 20 Fenchurch Street, better known as the Walkie Talkie, in London. In 2005, Christina left Raphael Vanoli to set up her own practice, Studio Seilen Architects. I joined Christina in a practice's light-filled offices in West London, where I started by asking her about her nationality.
I've got an Austrian father, a German mother, and a British passport. And I grew up in Switzerland.
Okay, just a British passport, one passport.
That's it.
Okay.
That's it, yeah.
And then lived in the States. And then,
so I studied in the States. Okay. So it's, you know, it's sort of I belong everywhere and I belong nowhere. Okay. Somehow I've always felt that this is where I would end up and this is where I belonged. And I think that's, right. I guess it's the pull of the passport. I don't know.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So you're born in
Switzerland
mm-hmm. and lived there for how long?
Until 18.
There was schooling in Switzerland.
Schooling in Switzerland.
In what language?
In French first, and then okay. I went to an international school because I barely spoke English.
Right, okay.
And so I went to an international school, and then at the age of 18 went to the States and to study and ended up staying 11 years there.
Right.
Okay. So doing undergrad and graduate and then working.
What did you study at?
I wanted to be a scientist. Right. I mean, interestingly enough, my father had said to my brother and I, you should either be an architect or a journalist. And and I was rebellious, so I thought I'd be neither. And and I wanted to do science. And I went off and worked. And this was a time when AIDS was being researched, and that was a big subject. And so I did an internship at the Institut Pasteur in Paris, and I thought it was very fascinating. I loved the empirical side of it, so it suited my character. It probably wasn't wild enough.
Right.
Ultimately, okay. It sort of lacked that zing. And then when I went to the States, I remember landing in Boston. I had never seen the university I was going to. and the scale of the buildings and the scale of everything. I mean, I grew up in Switzerland, sort of little Heidi chalets and very, you know, beautiful. And why
America then? What sort of drew you to?
I don't know. It was just, you know, it's sort of the dream of the American campus and the freedom. And again, my parents were very, I was very fortunate. They were always very happy to push in a direction that they hadn't experienced. And for them, it was this adventure. So I was very lucky to be able to do that and to be encouraged to do that.
They're not architects, are they?
What's no, that? My father's a developer.
Okay. So an interest in
an
building.
Interest, and I always grew around buildings, but he never developed from scratch so much as buying and managing.
Right.
But it's probably that's where I became aware of the profession.
Okay.
More than anything.
So you moved to the States for Wellesley.
For Wellesley, yeah. So yeah. I did a. Wellesley had this program. They didn't offer architecture. And so they had this program with MIT. And there I did my first course in architecture, and there was a Chilean professor who was absolutely brilliant. And MIT at the time was very, it wasn't what it is now, which is much more sort of academic, intellectual. It was much more hands-on.
Right.
You know, you build your model out of concrete blocks and things like that. You know, and the culture of staying up all night, of course, was there. But it was, you know, it was very hands-on. It was very much build your own house kind of thing. And it was interesting. It was a very good start to the project.
But Wellesley is an all-female.
It's an all-women's,
which in itself is quite novel.
Very strange.
In the UK, no one thinks kind of Eton as, well, maybe they do, but, you know, Eton is an all-male college, an all-male school. And then architecture is quite a male-dominated profession.
Yeah. Well, in my year at Wellesley, I was the only one studying architecture.
Right, okay.
So I was the only one doing that trip.
And so you would go to MIT then for the architecture.
Yeah, and I was the only... but... I mean, the reason I applied there was that when I was applying to American University, the Further Education Council mentioned Wellesley and thought it would be a great university for me. And I still don't know why. I was such a tomboy. and so I never really understood. But I applied to it because I wanted to please her, and she had to write us a recommendation. Right. So you had to be nice to this lady. And I wanted to please her. And so I applied there as well as all the other universities. Yeah. And then you do interviews with alums and whatever. And the woman who had been there, you know, wasn't a working woman, but she was so interesting. And she gave me such an amazing picture of it. And I thought, okay, well, I'll take that one a little bit more seriously. Right. And it was interesting because I'd never been to single-sex school.
No.
I mean, I in Switzerland, it's all co-ed.
Yeah.
There isn't that concept at all. I mean, there are, of course, there are a few schools like that, but the concept is not a normal one, and so I don't know. I kind of did it probably a little bit unconsciously, and I think in retrospect it was very interesting.
Yeah.
It took away the social aspect of university, because a lot of us had our social life outside of the university,
right?
Or at least I did, and so it sort of became a place of pure study and joy, and that was I did like that a lot, I have to say. But it was nice to have, you know, the dual MIT Wellesley thing.
The plan with MIT, you were always moving to the States to study architecture.
No, I went to the States to study science.
Right, okay.
And it was literally the landing in Boston and seeing the scale and suddenly thinking, oh, this is really exciting. And I remember very well that...
It was the city of Boston as much as anything else.
The city, and you arrive from the airport and you kind of go through a tunnel, and then you emerge and you're on an elevated highway, and you're sort of... have all these
skyscrapers, quite a kind of cluster.
Not quite skyscrapers like New York, but it's still that scale.
Exists.
And and I just thought, oh, this is really, I want to be part of that.
Right.
And so very early on, as soon as I could, I took the first foundation course of architecture, and that was my last class of biology.
Right.
That immediately got dropped and switched. And
that's fairly late on, maybe. Some of the people we speak to wanted to be architects at four or five, you know, we're kind of always sketching buildings.
I don't buy into that. I mean, maybe in retrospect. Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, there was my rebellious side that sort of wanted to rebel against anything that any parent would say. But, you know, I think, you know, probably it has to be in your radar to even notice buildings as you arrive. Yeah. So, and possibly because my father had this interest in buildings.
You were kind of primed to be looking.
Yeah. And my mother had studied interiors and she sort of, you know, she was always, for her, the environment in which she grew up was so important. So, you know, it was, the home was always incredibly carefully crafted. And so probably when you grow up like that, it's there. But but I certainly didn't declare myself an architect at the age of four. And I think it's weird. I mean, what four-year-old wants to be an architect? What do they, why do they even know what it is? But and my mother was an art dealer, so we were always around art and museums, and she always took us to, you know, Florence and Perugia to look at art and buildings, and so
there are early influences there.
Definitely, and I think I was exposed to it, but I wasn't with a sketchpad at the age of four. I was out beating up boys, I think.
And then, so 3 years at MIT for
four years undergrad. So you do four years undergrad. I mean, MIT itself, I don't know how many. I don't know. I probably started the second year, so it was probably 3 years, half. And then I went to Paris for a year. Okay. And again, this sort of wanting to test whether I really wanted to be an architect, because you kind of, you understand very early on that it's the first class that I took at MIT, they gave you a book saying, why not be an architect?
Right.
And it gave you the reality of the profession and, you know, all the sides that, you know, you're all trained to become sort of a Corbusier, but, you know, nobody tells you you've got to do partition schedules for 6 months. Yeah. And so it sort of, it showed you a little bit that reality of it. And then, so I went to Paris and this was 92, there was a recession, couldn't get a job as an architect. So I thought, well, I might as well do something useful that would test whether I really wanted to be an architect. And so I went where, you know, profession where they make money, and I went into banking. And that cured me very quickly of money.
So what did you do in a bank?
I worked in a Rothschild bank selling insurances, and it was it was fun. You know, I had to go traveling around all the wine countries and go and see wine merchants and sort of talk to them about their financial products, which I knew nothing of. You know, age 22. And but what was fun is that, you know, you'd get there at 10 o'clock in the morning and they'd open a bottle of wine and it was sort of, you know, it was the real sort of wine making country, and it was fascinating to see. So
a different approach, I guess, in France to in the States. I mean, a big kind of And do you think, I mean, is there anything there about the kind of business side then? I mean, obviously we'll come on to talking about starting our own practice and developing Vanoli's practice, you know, in scale, that kind of business angle there has actually been a fairly
successful. What, you mean in America?
Well, I mean, actually working for the bank. I mean, was there...
Well, I think it showed you, you know, I've also worked for a developer. I always think it's, you know, it's important to sort of step out of your own bubble sometimes and see how others live. And I, you know, I didn't marry an architect. I married somebody in finance, an entrepreneur. Okay. So it's sort of it's nice to see another world. And I think it sort of always enriches you. And you know, it sort of, it probably demystified that world and sort of made you realize that, or more realistic. There are, you know, there's some very intelligent people and some not very intelligent people like any other world. And,
So, what, a year in Paris, couple of years?
A year in Paris, yeah.
And then back to?
Back to grad school.
Okay. So that's when I went to New York.
Columbia and New York, And I spent the year in Paris putting together a portfolio and I went
so to... So fairly quickly you made a decision that then architecture was...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was, you know, it was the banking thing was because I couldn't get a job.
Right.
Yeah. It was a recession and it was very difficult. Architects just didn't have work at the time. And So I didn't want to sit around looking for a job for a year. So I just very quickly decided to do something else because I knew it was only going to be for a year. And then there was also the Beaux-Arts there. So I would take, I took drawing classes at the Beaux-Arts and sort of decided to really
expand
yourself
that way.
Enjoy that Paris, which had, you know, so much to offer. So that was really amazing. And they had a chapel there where they were, I guess, 18th, 19th century, they were prize winners who would go to Rome and Florence and, you know, paid by the government to go and copy some of the Renaissance pieces. And they had some pieces that the originals were demolished, and so they just had the copies there. So they just had this wealth of artifacts and sculptures, and we were allowed to sort of go and draw them. It was interesting. It was fun.
Now, are we talking then about kind of architectural language? Your mother tongue is French.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Two mother tongues, would you say?
Well, now, yes, probably. Yeah. I mean, I think if I have to present or work in French, I find it more difficult than English now.
Right.
Okay. Even though I started really learning English at the age of 15, but from...
Which is quite late, really, to learn. I mean, a lot of multilingual kids.
Yeah, but I mean, you've got to realize I grew up in Switzerland where everybody learns languages and speaks three languages from early on. So it's sort of... And I, you know, I've failed with my children. I mean, it's just, I'm struggling to teach them another language. Right. It's much more difficult here.
Because you're not surrounded by other...
You're not surrounded. Whereas Switzerland, there are four national languages, and you start from very early on to learn languages seriously. So it's sort of, I think it sort of comes maybe a little bit easier.
I was just kind of wondering though, whether it's maybe too simplistic, but just the kind of how language kind of shapes... is there anything about language shaping kind of architectural thinking, how you express kind of... Or is it just independent, actually? I mean, does architecture kind of transcend or cut across language?
I think, I'm not sure if it affects directly the architecture thinking, but I think it's been incredibly useful. I mean, we work in so many different countries, and I've had to, you know, I've done projects in so many different languages, and so my Swiss projects, I do them in German, and thank God I've got an Austrian girl with me who helps me with a very technical language. But you know, I've had to do now three projects in Swiss German, and you know, for example, the concert hall in Switzerland, the contractors Belgium, the M&E guy is Portuguese. So the project is run in French, German, and English in one meeting. It's sort of whoever language is there, everybody understands the other language, but is less comfortable speaking in it. So you're finding that a lot. And I think the ability to be able to connect to another country in their own language has been very useful.
Right. So, I guess to kind of think about the client's background and their kind of cultural references and things.
And so, you know, if I go to Spain, I'll try to speak Spanish and do all of that. And I think it sort of immediately creates a much more intimate relationship with the consultants, with the clients, and they'll feel that you're less foreign.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think this notion of localism is important. And so all the projects that we do abroad, we always have somebody who's from that place and has that culture and understands that culture. And I think that's really important. So when we were doing one of our biggest projects is in Lithuania, and it's a mixed-use project. And when we started it 8 years ago, we were working with a local practice. And Lithuania is a very young country because it was occupied by the Soviets. And then sort of, I think, 91 was a time of independence. So in its jurisdiction and in its government, it was a very, very young country that was still trying to come to terms of how to define yourself. Yeah. And so in planning terms, it was very young, not like here. And in terms of government, it was very young. Mm. And you had, even in the planning side, you had the old Soviet mentality kind of people. And then you had the younger guys who just wanted to reshape the whole thing. And so when we started working with a local architect, whatever we presented, his view was, it's not going to work. It doesn't fit planning. It doesn't work in Lithuania. And so there was always this barrier of, you don't understand, you're not Lithuanian. So I said to the client, please trust me, I will hire a Lithuanian architect in-house. Let us do the planning. Let us take it through. And then if we can't manage, then, you know, give me 6 months. And the client sort of luckily went along with it. And we hired a young Lithuanian guy who stayed with us for many years, and he's great. And I had him translate the entire planning regulations and the entire building control regulations. And we kind of, you know, pulled up our sleeves and figured out what it is, what it means to be Lithuanian and what it means to build in Lithuania. And so we started approaching it in a Lithuanian manner. And I would have him present with me, and then we approached the planners, and everything that we thought we wouldn't be able to get, we ended up getting everything because we approached it from their own language, their own planning history, their own planning regulations. And so we kind of gave up the fact that we were British architects. Yeah. We were just foreign architects who understood their planning better than they did. And we started using arguments and explaining why some things didn't make sense in their own planning regulations. So, for example, there was an issue with the old town. One of the regulations is that it had to have clay tiles. And we said, we explained that actually clay tiles means that you have to have V-luxes and it kind of kills the Baroque architecture. Mm-hmm. And so we showed them another way where you had metal roofs and a contemporary interpretation of the Baroque, but it was much more in keeping with the Baroque. And so their response was, it's very radical. It's not what we're used to, but we understand it makes sense. And therefore we're willing to go beyond that planning regulations and accept this. And so they made some sort of alterations to the planning.
Rule breaking, coming back again, radical.
Adapting. And that the fact that it's a young, jurisdiction allowed it to do that. And so you could use
And again, I suppose, logic. A little bit like the law kind of setting precedent that way for then others to follow as a kind of case.
But they're not used to that. Right. I mean, I don't really know what their legal system is like. I wouldn't even pretend to know. But I don't think they're based on case studies.
It's more kind of civil law and things that are written.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So, so that's language and culture. So I think it's probably helped a lot in terms of, if somebody says, where are you from? My answer is very long. And that's allowed us to work abroad. And it's allowed me to feel very comfortable in going in any country and sort of, figuring out, understanding a culture, because I've had to live in so many different cultures and it comes much more naturally.
And then, grad school is 2 years?
3 years.
3 years, okay.
3 years, yeah.
In New York.
In New York.
Must have been, again, from, via Boston, but still a big, big change from
amazing.
Small town.
I don't think I slept for 3 years.
Well, the city never sleeps.
The city never sleeps, and then it's such an amazing, fun place. Yeah. I mean, 22 in New York, it's sort of, every corner is so vibrant, and it's just... I remember once looking at a street and you could see that there was talent, you had these amazing photographers and these amazing artists and all in one street, and you're just sort of the drive of that city.
I mean, I guess was Juilliard, is this kind of time of Giuliani?
Yeah.
As mayor, so quite a different city.
Cooper
maybe.
Union,
Quite kind of a bit more edgy, maybe.
Much
now.
More gritty, much more ambitious. Yeah. And you really, also much more transient. I think Boston is more of a family place and student place, yes, but it sort of has much more. Whereas there, when you live there, the churn of people would come and stay for 4 years and leave again and come and then the ones who settled into a very New York life. But there was this period where you had, you had every possible nationalities, and I had a lot of South American friends, and that was fascinating because I would go and travel with them, and it was just sort of you were thrown in this very international, very gritty and very ambitious world. And
a hard city then to live in. I mean, does that kind of grit mean that? I mean, is that one of the reasons people move on? Is just it's a slog.
Yeah, I think if you probably. settle down and have children, it probably is less cozy than sitting in a Swiss Alp, you know. and it's a certain character, and it's just, you know, working at Vignoli, I remember, you know, I'd get there at 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, and I'd leave at 9:30, 10. And I remember this Spanish guy who, it was his first day in the office, and he was sitting there looking around, and it was sort of 7:30, and he was going, "But I can't believe this, what's going on?" And I go, "Well, what's wrong?" He goes, "Is no one going home?" And I go, "No, it's only 7:30.
Yeah, just having lunch."
You know, but you'd sort of work until 9:30, 10, and then you'd go out, and then you'd sort of go out until 1 o'clock, and then you'd be back in the office at 7:30. Yeah. But you were young, and it was exciting. And the other thing is, you felt that you were doing something which was such a higher purpose and meaningful. It was sort of, I think ambition was celebrated more, and it's sort of, you worked incredibly hard and you played incredibly hard, and probably that gets a little bit exhausting after a while, but it's a good thing to do.
So was it straight out of Colombia then you found the job with? No.
First, I worked for an architect who she was architect/interior designer, and she was doing her first new build, and I think she just threw a lot of money at me out of grad school, and I just thought, okay, I'll do that, and stayed there for a year, and then I was hired by a developer. And I remember speaking to I.M. Pei's son and sort of asking who was, you know, sort of a 45 or 50-year-old architect, and I had met him, and asking him whether he thought, he had his own practice, whether he thought it was a good thing to do. And he had said that I.M. Pei had done that for a while, and it's a good thing to see the other side. And so I did that for about a year as well. And it was really interesting to see the other side. But then I just wanted to go back to the design, and then I got a job at Vignoli. The only job that I could get in that office was for a fraction of the pay of what I was getting. I mean, really a fraction of the pay, and in the model shop, and sort of, you know, being the fifth assistant to the 17th model maker. But I took it because I just liked. I had seen a lecture that Rafael had given at Columbia, and I had no idea who he was. And he talked.
But still at the time, kind of less. I mean, less well known than he is now.
I think in the States he was well known, but you know, I was a young student, and I hadn't sort of discovered him, and he came to give this lecture, and all the lectures at Columbia were very, very academic and slightly pedantic, and he talked about the Tokyo Forum, and he talked about this one connection, and he talked about why that one connection was so important, and it was so much about the love of building. And I was just totally fascinated because I hadn't had that language at Columbia. We never talked about building. We talked about theory. We talked about concepts. But this thing of the love of building was very, very, you know, sort of you could feel it in his talk. And so I was fascinated. So when I had a chance of, and I remember somebody who was working there said, "It's terrible. You work such long hours and." Yeah. And, you know, it's terrible for women. I don't know why he said that, because I thought it was absolutely brilliant for women. I mean, he just, there was no difference, right? Yeah. It was sort of, but so it started there, and then slowly I got moved up to projects, and then I started working with Rafael directly, and it was sort of, we just had this very easy understanding. I think it was just, I got what he wanted, and, you know, and
it's quite hard to express a lot of the time. You just kind of know it when you feel it, I guess, that kind of connection somehow.
We all worked incredibly hard in this office because he did. And he, you know, he had this absolute belief that whatever we did was the most important thing that one could ever do. And you should only do it if you think that way. Yeah. And I think that was, you know, it was wonderful. And so very early on, he then put me onto a project in Princeton, and it was for the Genomics Institute.
Right.
And I think, you know, it was this science thing. So I did a research, a molecular biology research center in Queen's College for the guy who researched AIDS at the Institut Pasteur. Okay. And so when I told Raphael, you know, I did a summer internship at the Institut Pasteur, he was like, that's it, you're a scientist, you're on that project.
And you know how scientists work.
Yeah, and it was kind of, it was really interesting how it sort of came back round. And so I was sort of labeled the scientist in the office. And so I was given all the labs to do. And so first we did Queen's and then Princeton University. And that's the thing about architecture, is that it throws you in so many different worlds. Mm-hmm. And you discover these other worlds in a very intimate level. So, you know, you get to speak to Nobel Prize winners about their research, mm-hmm. because you need to understand how they work. And so it's sort of, you know,
probably understand how they work better than they, because they've not ever codified or kind of written it down at all.
Yeah, and it's sort of, and interestingly enough, the ones who understood architecture the best, I think, were the scientists, because they, you know, there is this empirical thinking and this logical thinking, and yet you also have to be very creative to be a good scientist. Yeah. And so I think these two skills are very linked to architecture. I think probably music is the same. But so they had this ability to understand what we did probably better than most other clients. And
so you've got, I think there's something about architects enjoy working with scientists, I guess, because they're just
intelligent.
And clear what they want, I suppose, and kind of clear in terms of kind of structuring.
Yeah.
How big was the practice then when you joined Vinoli in New York?
They must have been 120, 150. Right. Okay. I think they've always more or less stayed, been growth spurts, but I think that was at the time.
Right. Okay.
At the time,
and
it
that's
was
his principal office was always New York.
Yeah. And then at the time, my now husband had the opportunity to move to London, and I always had eyed moving to London. And so he moved, and then so I went to Raphael, and I said, "Thank you so much for this wonderful experience." And but you know, somebody's time to move on. Yeah. And he said, absolutely not. You're absolutely not doing that. First of all, you've got to finish Princeton. You cannot leave a project in the middle. Oh, right. And he said, you should do this for yourself, not for me, because I can replace you tomorrow. But for yourself, you should finish this. And I think he's absolutely right. You know, each project takes so much time. Mm. And so if you're sort of only doing the beginning stages and you kind of leave it early on, there is this huge gap in understanding how the making of the building happens from the beginning until the end. So that was a very good piece of advice. And then as I stayed probably for another 6 or 8 months, I can't remember, but as that happened, he then started asking, you know, bringing up the notion of setting up an office in London. So I had come to London to interview engineers, because we wanted to work with British engineers on several projects. So I had started sort of to meet engineering practices, but I knew really nothing about London. And so I said, you know, he kind of said to me, if you move to London, you've got to make it big, you've got to make it great. You can't just go there and send your CV and try to get a job. Yeah. I didn't know what that meant. I mean, I had no idea, but that was, you know, that's the way he all thinks. Oh, he thinks sort of, you know, sort of beyond what you're expected to think. And he sort of always approaches it from another angle. And so I thought, well, that's an interesting proposal. Don't really know what it means. And then I said, okay, let's try this. But I had never, you know, I had never secured a job. I didn't even know to set up an office. I didn't really know what it required. I didn't know accounting, forget it, all of that. So I tried to sort of put together a business plan, and he kept saying, forget that. It's your instinct. It's your instinct. Yeah. So, and then eventually, you know, we literally, I think a week before I moved to London, we got a letter from Amsterdam saying, you've been commissioned to do a project, a tower in Amsterdam.
Wow.
So it was complete, I don't know, somebody must have listened up there. But suddenly I had a job to do. And I think that was really key, because...
And the job was going to be run out of the London...
And the job was going to be run out of the London office. So I had something to do beyond just looking for a job. And thank God, because it's, you know... To secure a job and to understand how to go about that and where to find them and which ones are the right ones takes a lot of experience, and that's one thing I was really lacking was that. And also to show up as a 29-year-old into a developer's office, I mean, for them to take you seriously as a woman is, you know, it's there are these barriers. So thank God I had this this project to do. And then I didn't really know how to go about it, and then I kept doing OJECs because they were open. Yeah. And then finally I remember going to the Curve interview in Leicester. Mm-hmm. And I had put together the pitch, and we were shortlisted, and it was great. And I went to all of the architects' briefing, and it was all these guys with beards, and there was like the directors from Foster and this and that, and here I was. And they were all claiming specialization and experience, and I just claimed freshness. And so, because I was like, well, what else do we have? So we're fresh, we're new, we're the new kid on the block. And what he was very good at is just it's to sort of give me the conviction that's been absolutely key in setting up this office. If you have your own conviction and you kind of go, well, it doesn't matter, I don't know, just do it, then you know you have a chance at getting to it. So I remember picking him up at the airport, and I had put together a whole PowerPoint presentation, and we arrived and we went to the lounge. He had breakfast. I briefed him. I explained to him. I said, da, 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 and this is what we're saying, and all of that. And then as we're driving up, and I go, by the way, if we don't get this job, I quit. This is too difficult. Yeah. I declare failure. Yeah. So he goes, well, we better get this job. And thankfully, we got it. So then it sort of it grew. And I think in 5 years, we eventually grew to 50 people, and then I was ready to move on. But it was probably the most difficult thing I've ever done. Yeah. But it sort of definitely made me grow up very quickly.
Right.
And it sort of it's in a sense it's now I feel that I'm very comfortable dealing with large scale projects. Mm. And I'm still probably, you know, we do both scales. We do the small, intimate scale as well as the large scale. And we've just secured a tower. I'm not supposed to be talking about it, but so I'm not necessarily where and how. But so it's sort of, now we kind of manage both scales, and I want to keep it that way. But it's sort of... It was a great schooling in terms of understanding how to put together a project, how to pitch for a job, and how to think about putting together an idea.
Is that something you miss then? I mean, as an architect leaving 50 strong practice,
because actually the scale that we're at now, I absolutely love. I think it's sort of now we feel like a...
But was that something you missed at...
Originally, when I set up my own practice, it was complete panic because I thought I'd just be doing kitchen renovations.
Right.
And it's, I mean, it's extraordinary where, you know, you set up your own practice and still today, you know, people say, so what do you do? I'm an architect. Oh, residential, first question. Why residential? Yeah. Well, also residential, but no, I do concert halls and I do performing arts centers and schools and, okay. And the other question I get always asked is, oh, do you do the interiors of buildings? No, I can also do a chimney and a roof. And
is that?
So I think that has to do with the women thing.
Yeah.
And I think it's sort of still, I think it's changing. I think that we've had more women in the press that people start understanding that actually there are some women who have been able to be architects. But it's, I don't get that question so much in the profession, but outside of the profession. Yeah. It's more, I think women are more seen as interiors, and probably there are more interior designers who are women than men. I don't know. So you've got to get over that. And so a lot of the times now when I present the architecture, but I also go incredibly technical very, very early on, just to show that it's not just a pretty picture. So you've got to be practically, more technical.
So the big, before you come on to your your practice, the big project at Vanoli in London, I guess people will know, is 20 Fenchurch Street. Was that, were you involved in the bidding there, or how did that?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. So we were invited on the One New Change competition.
Right. Okay.
And we were finalists with Nouvelle.
Yeah. Who won the competition?
End, and I think the balancing was that their retail proposal probably was stronger. They had more retail than we did, and so it was a very close call. And but we immediately then, very shortly afterwards, got invited by Landsec to look at 20 Fenchurch Street, and I think that wasn't a, that wasn't a competition. It was a competitive interview, but it was we pretty much got it very quickly. And Mike Hussey at the time was running it, and he got on with Raphael immediately, very well. Right. And it was, you know, it was very interesting to do. It was our first tall building in London, and I was trying to explain to Raphael, you know, if you come from New York and you've got zoning laws, it's sort of your building is practically designed by zoning regulations in New York, right? It's so prescriptive as to what you can do. Whereas here, it's not. It's planning regulations and they're planning guidances. Yeah. So Raphael was saying, well, how tall can we go? I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, it's whatever we can argue.
Yeah.
Well, and what's this cluster? Because are we in the cluster or outside the cluster? Well, we're on the edge of the cluster. So can we go tall? Well, it's whether we can argue it. So it was sort of, we had to adapt our thinking. And so we went very quickly to Peter Rees with a very tall structure. And then he sent us back very quickly and said, no, don't be ridiculous. And then we kind of,
Because there's pressure from a developer, from Land Securities to kind of maximize floor space and maximize.
I mean, it's, you know, everybody all slams on developers, but it's, you know, they're in it. Yeah. I mean, it's their profession, it's their business. And obviously they've got shareholders and, you know, so there is a commercial aspect to architecture that can't be ignored. And, and we can't sort of just call hard-nosed, nasty developers who don't care about architecture. But I think that people like Peter Rees made them really think about architecture and you know, forced them to come back with commercial propositions that were also good pieces of architecture. And so I think a planner has a very important role in influencing, you know, what a city will end up being. You know, if the developer is purely given a free rein, then obviously, you know, the cheaper the better, the easier the better, the fastest to build the better, because, you know, you're always responding to a boss who then, there's a board of governors, and then there's the, you know, there's the shareholders who care about their share price. So I think the checks and balances is very important. But what happened is that actually, you know, the relationship between Mike Hussey and Peter Rees was that they were both very excited about architecture. And that's when it becomes really interesting, when you're dealing with the real thing, because you're dealing with a commercial proposition. You're dealing with the fact that you've got to, you know, deliver something to budget, and the numbers have to stack up. And yet you're also trying to do something which is architecturally strong and important. And you know, it's a building that's been very criticized, and I think to many levels unfairly so.
So how quickly then, I mean, for people who aren't themselves architects, how, you know, with the walkie-talkie, with Fenchurch Street, how quickly does the kind of shape or the form of the building emerge? Is that something that you together designed? How, where's the kind of point of...
What we do is we tend to do a lot of options.
Okay.
And that was a trick that I learned from Vignoli, and I still use it. It's sort of, you use a lot of options, and you tend to, funnily enough, the first idea is always the one that comes out and always the one that wins. But we never declare which one the first idea is. But the reason we do a lot of options is not that we're schizophrenic and can't make up our minds about what the building should be. It's just a way of interviewing the client or interviewing the planners. So, you know, I'll tend to go very early to the planners with a scheme that I may not want to push through, but it's just a tool for interviewing and to understand how they see the city or how they will interpret our project, and same with the clients, and sort of understanding what, because you know, there are so many factors that affect a building. So obviously there is the architect, you know, and the making of the building, but there's the city, the site, the planning, the stakeholders, the client, the users. I mean, there's so many things that affect what you do. And so I think what we do is we take all of this information and we turn it into something. We kind of put it all in the mixer and then something comes out of it. And I think this early stage of interview is very important. So the idea of bringing several ideas means that they can react to, well, this works, but that doesn't work. Mm. And then they can explain why this works and that doesn't work. Whereas if you only show one idea, they say, well, I don't really like it, but I don't know why.
So you're kind of developing a framework for conversation with them, I guess, giving them a kind of tool to...
Yeah.
Right, okay.
And sometimes, and sometimes we'll show them a ridiculous idea. but it's just sort of, or a wacko idea, and it's just sort of to... and people will always come and saying, I want you to do this, and this is, I want, put this there and put that there. And this happened in Wellington College, and I think, you know, we were invited for the competitions. There were some very big names there. We were given less time than the others because we were invited at a later stage, and the school said, well, we want you to put the foyer here and the new performing arts center there, and this is what we want. And there was this brief, and it was very, and I just thought they have it so wrong.
Yeah.
It's exactly what you shouldn't do, because they're just...
They're wanting to be architects themselves almost.
No, but it was just that was a logical thing. Yeah. They had a problem. They had a scar in their campus. They had this sort of sunken auditorium that I call the bear pit that nobody used, and they just wanted to cover it up. So they said, put the foyer here in the sunken auditorium, and then you put the new auditorium, the 1,200 seat next to it, and you kind of connect it all. But the problem is that the sunken auditorium was at -5 meters from the campus. So you still had this problem. They had to go down a hall in order to get down to your foyer. So that was where we essentially won the competition, because we did exactly the opposite in saying, you know, you've got to put the public spaces at the street level, at the campus level, and then you've got to negotiate all of these levels. And so we found this very gentle way of connecting the campus and the levels of the theater and the stage level, et cetera, et cetera, in a much more gentle, accessible way than what they had done before. And so it's interesting. It's sometimes a client comes with a very strong idea, and then you hit them back with a disobeying them and with something completely different.
And some clients respond to that.
They kind of go, oh, okay. And when you're doing a competition, you can't propose three things. So that, you know, you can only propose one thing. So you've got to stick by your idea. But when you're interviewing a client, sometimes we'll come up with two solutions and then see how they react.
So a 50 strong practice at Vanoli.
Mm-hmm.
What was the kind of, you moved to London, you weren't moving again, so it wasn't a
it was prompt home. To... I was married, so you I started home. Having children.
What was the kind of driving factor then to think,
well,
time
a friend of mine who had gone to Columbia, and she went the other way, where she started her practice very early on, straight out of school, rather than going and working for larger practices. So she had done another route, and at the time, I don't think she had done any new build yet. And she had a friend who needed to do a project in East Africa. And so he approached her and he said, you know, I want to do a house. He had a big tobacco farm and he wanted to build his house there to show his workers that he's there, he's investing. He's Austrian, so they're investing and building his home and sort of, you know, providing them job security, I guess. And so she approached me and saying that, you know, would you want to do this project with me? She hadn't done a new build, and this is all I had done. And she had done a lot of, I think, retail and residential interiors. So we were kind of the perfect match for this residential building. And I hadn't done that scale. So I had done the, you know, 20 Fenchurch and the Curve, and it was everything was 60 million, 250 million. And so I felt I had lost a bit this, the touch of, you know, this intimate detail element. So it felt like a very good match. We, you know, that was a good thing that we weren't, we were very complementary in our skills. And so I thought, gosh, a building in Zimbabwe in a country that's imploding. I mean, is this sort of the right project to use? And then I met the clients and they were just so great. You know, they were so smart and they were, you know, they just, they really wanted to be ambitious about what they wanted to do, and they wanted to do something out of the ordinary, and they, you could immediately feel that they were in this journey with you, and they didn't just want sort of, I want a pretty house that I can put in a magazine and
can show off with,
and show off with. They really wanted to be part of the process, and they were engaged and engaging, and so then I said to Vignoli, that was probably the fourth time I quit, because I would always quit and he wouldn't let me. But this time he said, okay, fine, you're ready. You're fine, our office is fine. And then he very kindly offered for us to set up our office within the office. So that was very nice, because I still, you know, kept contact with everybody, and we were sharing resources. And it was a very nice thing to do in retrospect, because you... You know, you could also invite clients in an office that looked like a proper office rather than somebody's garage.
So you started then, what, initially you didn't take staff with you?
No, so it was Mutia and I. Mutia was my friend. And it was, that was the great part, because, you know, at the problem when you work in a large practice and you're sort of running these larger projects is you're constantly... managing teams, but the thing of actually you drawing the detail yourself or you making the model yourself, you don't do that anymore. So
turn around and ask someone for help.
So I need a model and this is what I need, and you do all of that all the time, but the sort of sitting down and actually, you know, doing the CAD drawings, doing the 3D. So we couldn't afford anyone, first of all, but it was really great because we ended up doing the models ourselves. I taught myself Rhino, and I started. I did the 3D models ourselves, and my friend hadn't done AutoCAD, so she taught herself AutoCAD, and we kind of, you know, we did everything ourselves, and we had to do the accounting ourselves and all of that, and that was great. I think it was. I enjoyed that so much. The sort of. And also, you know, 20 Fenchurch, you go to a meeting and there's 20 consultants and client reps, right? And everybody's dressed in a suit and tie and they're all questioning what you're doing. And there, you know, it was suddenly you had one client. This case, two clients. It was a couple. And, you know, we would sit around my dining room table having a glass of wine and talking about it. So it was...
much more civilized.
It was, you know, I came sort of all professional with my presentations and they were slightly giggling about it. But it was, it sort of brought back the human side. And that's what I hadn't realized until I did it, that there was this whole human side to it that I think sometimes gets lost in the large practices. And that's why I'm very keen on still keeping the scales, the two scales that we have. And I think we'll always keep that. We'll always do the smaller jewel-like residential projects, our projects now starting to get bigger and bigger, and that's great. I love that, and I feel very comfortable in that world of larger projects.
Got the background there. When did you leave?
I think it was 2005.
Okay.
2004, 2005. Yeah.
Then not long before, you know, you talk a lot in architecture about recessions, which keep coming through, but not long before.
We were just heading down the hole. but it was, I mean, and that's probably where this experience of Vignoli and being thrown into the deep water and it's sort of sink and swim kind of situation, where I was thrown into London to set up an office and I had to figure out how to get a job.
Yeah.
And so it was the same thing. The recession was happening and I remember the time 2008 happened. We were probably five in the office or six, or maybe a little bit more. I can't remember. Mm. But suddenly the phone rang one week, and three of our jobs were cancelled out of four.
Wow.
And I just thought, oh my god! So I've got to fire everyone now. And I didn't want to fire anyone, right? And So we had this one thing that people didn't have, which was experience in Africa. And mm-hmm. my husband had just set up a business in Nigeria. So right. I heard a lot him talking. He does a lot of conference calls at home. So I overheard him a lot talking to his partners, right. his Nigerian partners about Nigeria and how it's booming and how yeah. everything was happening. And so I went to see his partners and I kind of said, well, I'd love to meet people yeah. in Africa. And so I took two people from my office and we did a tour of Africa mm-hmm. and we went pitching. And literally we would have something like 20 meetings in a day just pitching. And some, I mean, ridiculous meetings with the most ridiculous people. Yeah. And some of them were, okay, well, yeah. that could lead to something. Yeah. And we came back with four jobs. So suddenly wow. we had yeah. stuff to do. The problem with Africa is you do need a very, very strong client. And it's something mm-hmm. that I hadn't realized until you kind of need your, you know, it's sort of the, a little bit like in the Renaissance, you need your king, you know, yeah. the guy who makes it all happen or the woman who makes it all happen. You need that.
Someone who makes the decisions.
The decision maker yeah. who drives the project and more importantly knows how to put together the funding. And mm-hmm. so what I realize in my experience in working in Nigeria is that, you know, they're huge risk takers. And so, you know, the ambitions are always very, very high. But the funding behind, because the borrowing costs are between yeah. 15% and 20%, so right. yeah. it still doesn't really stack up for the kind of first world development. So there's a very high risk yeah. in every project. Yeah. So you know, we designed these four projects, and one of them is building, right. And I don't think the other three will ever get built, and that's a little bit the problem. Yeah. Okay. And because. You know, we are architects who love building.
Yeah. You don't just want to have some nice plans in a book somewhere.
No, they just have the ambition to do it. Yeah. But then yeah. it's so stacked up against mm. you, the execution, in terms of the funding and in terms of even construction costs incredibly high. Yeah. So, for example, we were doing a project in Lagos, outside of Lagos, and concrete had to be imported. It's very unenvironmental, it's very expensive, so we decided to do the structure out of rammed earth. And so, you know, we had to find a lab that would test the strength of the rammed earth, and so it sort of leads you to very exciting and new solutions that you necessarily you could do here, but it, you know, why would you do it yeah, here? It makes less sense. Yeah. Whereas there, it's sort of you're driven by the lack of a sophisticated construction industry, and it sort of drives you to new solutions. Right. And same with the environmental sustainable design. You know, the grid works 30% of the time, and therefore, sustainable yeah. design is a necessity rather than
a nice to have or
you know, a planning regulation. Yeah. It's sort of, you know, you have to go down that route, and that's quite refreshing.
Practice now started off renting a couple of desks from
Mignoli's. Yeah.
How long were you there for? When did you then decide to?
Well, we moved here last year, and then we kind of then grew and took the space next door to them. But we were still all one big open plan office. And then at one point, they had a new director, and they wanted to move into the city. So then they moved out, and we kept. The office eventually.
Right, okay.
And then, so I had been in that office for about 15 years and I was so ready
to get your own space and to, yeah.
Yeah, and then we found this space, which was so great. And, you know,
just say where we are then.
We are, so Scrubs Lane, so we're right. north of Wormwood Scrubs and White City. And we're overlooking a Catholic cemetery, which is. Really what I wanted my desk to look at this calmness and peacefulness. and you know, these large windows, a lot of light and green. In the summer, it's spectacular because we've got this row of big trees in front of us. So it's a wonderful environment. And we have this space that we can breathe in and a big model shop.
Big space. How many staff now? What size is the practice?
I don't know. I think we're 25, something like that.
Right, okay.
You'd have to ask Henriette.
Yeah. Creeping back up then. Yeah, back towards that kind of 50. I mean,
But you know, there's
25
such
a... 25 is a nice...
It's a really great size. It's actually it's the size when you are operating as a proper office and you still have 100% control of every project. So I really understand every single detail of every project, and you can still manage that at 25. At 50, becomes a little bit more difficult. And once you're 150, then it sort of becomes more difficult. So it's sort of what I like about this size is it's really, I think it's the time when you're no longer stressed about, oh, do I have enough, you know, experienced people that I can deliver these jobs? I've got some, you know, wonderfully strong architects here who've come from very, very good offices. Mm-hmm. And so they're, it's no longer a one-man show, which I think is when it becomes a really proper office, I think, is when it sort of moves away from being a one-man show. And it no longer relies solely on me. And so there are people who really drive this. Yeah.
And then just kind of as we start just to round up, you know, where next for the practice are you in terms of plans for?
I think it's, you know, the last couple of years has been so fundamentally life-changing. I think in terms of the projects we've been getting, I mean, I think the start of it was Wellington College.
Right.
And doing a performing arts center, and you know, having had done the Curve in Leicester, it's a building typology that I loved, and I wanted to get back into it. So that was the first one, and now I'm doing a concert hall in Andermatt in Switzerland, and we've been going around with a client, and we went to see Barenboim in Berlin in his new hall, and we went to listen to his rehearsals and. You know, he's given us quite a bit of advice. It's a whole musical world that I've loved, and I've actually learned to love through Raphael because he is a musician, and so that's been really fundamental in terms of getting back into that building typology. We've also been doing a lot of schools, educational, so that's great. And now we're. I think next year we have three important projects opening. So this year and next year, so that's really key for us to sort of see this hard work coming to fruition. And now we've just won this competition for a 300-meter tower. So it's sort of the scale.
Yeah. Okay.
Is
when will you be able to talk? When will you be able to?
That we
know
can't
more
talk
about.
Okay. But. But you know, once we can, you'll be the first to hear. But it's sort of we've moved from. I think people now understand that we do have the ability to deliver significant projects, and I think, you know, we've won these projects through the hard work, but also I think it's the strength of the ideas, and that's I think. It sounds really basic, but the fact that we've moved into a large office space with a lot of light and breathing space has completely changed the way we can think and work. And I've never attached so much importance to the quality of the office space. And that's why we're so out of the central London, because the rents here are affordable. And if we were more central, we'd be all crammed into an office and sitting on top of each other, and so I believe all the architects are in East London, and they pay twice as much as we do. Yeah, but we've
for
got
half the space.
For half the space, and that's exactly what I didn't want. I just, I guess that's the rebellious side. I didn't want to be where everybody else was. And
what a nice way to finish on the building, having such an influence on the architects.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Thank you. Well, you've been so very generous.
Thank you.
Time.
It's
been fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. On the programme this week was Christina Silone. You can find out more about Christina and her work at architecturemasters.org, where you can also subscribe to the programme and follow us on Twitter. If you've enjoyed the show, why not leave a review or a rating through your podcast provider, as this helps others to discover the programme. You can also send any comments, questions or suggestions by email to hello@architecturemasters.org. I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.